Hey, it's Francis Lamb, host of The Splendid Table. Every week on our show, we talk about food and cooking and the meanings of food and cooking. We talk with the most interesting people in food about their techniques, their culture, and everything in between. Whether it's about how fried chicken took over the world or how Instagram changes the way people are actually eating. It's a food show where everyone is welcome. Come join us. You can listen to The Splendid Table wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network.
HRN is food radio supported by you. Learn more at heritageradionetwork.org.
Today's program is brought to you by Corin, a supplier of Japanese chef knives and restaurant supplies. For more information, visit corin.com.
Hello, welcome to Japan Eats. I'm your host, Akiko Tema, food writer and the director of the New York Japanese Culinary Academy, which promotes a deep understanding of Japanese cuisine in America. We are broadcasting live from Brooklyn, New York. This show is all about Japanese food and food culture. We see sushi at every day in the supermarket, but what is beyond sushi? We hear dashi ramen izakaya, but what exactly are they? Japanese food is still a mystery for many people, and I try to demystify it in this program with my cool guests. My guest today is Morgan Adamson, who is a chef at Hoseki, a six-seat omakase sushi bar located at Saks Fifth Avenue in Manhattan. In previous episodes, we had several long Japanese sushi chefs who proved that America has a distinctive pool of talents and that American sushi culture is on healthy ground. And Morgan is definitely one of these talents, and being female, she is particularly unique as the traditional sushi industry has been notorious for not welcoming females to lead the sushi counter. So today we'll discuss how a young woman from Michigan got into sushi, how she studied sushi making and built a successful career, a unique concept of Hoseki where she expresses her own sushi making philosophy, advice to future sushi chefs in America, and much, much more. But before you start, Japanese is available on the Heritage Radio Network website, as well as on iTunes, Stitcher, and Spotify as a podcast. So please go to iTunes, Stitcher, and Spotify, whichever you listen to, and subscribe to Japanese. And please write a review. Truly appreciate your feedback. Now let's start a conversation with Morgan Adamson. Hello, Morgan. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, Akiko-san.
So this is exciting, female sushi chef in America. This used to be unthinkable. Exciting fact. So now, to get to know you, where you're from and what did you eat when you grew up?
I'm from Southwest Michigan, an area called Battle Creek. It's a manufacturing town, also known as Cereal City. Actually my grandparents worked for Kellogg. My dad works for Kellogg. So needless to say, I was eating a lot of cereal. eating for me growing up was mostly about necessity and not so much, you know, like a big celebration. But probably a really special meal that we would have would be my Nana's biscuits and gravy.
That sounds amazing. That's the most American thing possible. And I'm a sushi chef. So. So, but you know, why did you want to become a sushi chef growing up in that very particular American environment?
Yeah, you know, I didn't grow up wanting to be a sushi chef. There's not a lot of sushi in my hometown really at all. But I grew up I thought of myself more as like a creative person. I wasn't very academic, so I wasn't really encouraged for that. It was more like, oh, like Morgan's, she's nice and she like does some drawing kind of thing, you know, dancing, whatever. And so that's kind of what I leaned into. But I also had a really big appreciation for people who were really disciplined. Like I said, my sister and I grew up dancing and we took it really seriously. And yeah, I appreciate that. So I've had a lot of different jobs. And one of the jobs I had before I got into sushi was working for an oral surgeon's office. I did implant treatment coordination. And I liked it. And I liked working for this oral surgeon because he was really passionate about what he was doing, obviously, and worked really hard. And everything was, just taken so seriously. But at the end of the day, it's like people are coming in and they're not really happy to be there. And I'm not making anything. And I had had some experience in the past working in prep kitchens. And there was a restaurant in town called Maru that was hiring to apprentice, like let people come in and learn the craft. So I just kind of went for it. And they let me work there.
Right. So tell us more about Maru Sushi. And I know that it's a very successful business, and now they have 6 locations. So who's the owner and what kind of chef's training did you have?
Well, the owner is Robert Song. The chef, you know, I haven't like kept up with how things are these days, but it was Chef Moon at the time. And it's a Japanese-Korean fusion restaurant. They do have some things on the menu called omakase, but that was just basically us making little platters and mixing some different flavors and putting in random fish, but it was a lot of sushi rolls.
I took a look at the menu, and I heard that Mr. Sung is from South Korea, and he's passionate about food. And I really think that Korean chefs are now really started to dominate all the Michelin stars. So Korean people are very passionate about food. Right. Okay. So what did you learn from the experience at the Maru Sushi?
Well, I would say, I mean, I guess I'm kind of look back now and think that I got some blind confidence, because I thought, you know, I'd worked there for a couple of years. And I'm like, I wanted to come to New York and work as a chef. And I'm like, I know sushi. You know, because I've done the thing, but like, you know, in Michigan we have salmon, yellowtail, and tuna, and that's basically it. So really, I have learned a lot of delusion. But also, how do I identify a healthy fish? I think was a big part. Making rice, and really the importance of building relationships with everybody in the restaurant, like the delivery guys, the managers, servers, and chefs, because the better your relationship is with people around you, the more opportunity I felt I had. Like if I wanted to learn something new, people were more willing to show me because I was respectful to their role. You know,
right. And also sushi is known for the specific skill required to build a network with fishermen and all those market people. So I think that human element is very important to consider sushi business career, I think. So, yeah, and then in 2021, you were recruited to work at the New York City makase spot called Kisaki. So what is Kisaki, and how did your move to New York happen, which you wanted to have, right?
Yeah, I love this question because I was not recruited. They posted a position for an omakase sushi chef with a minimum of 2 years experience in sushi, which I had that. I sent several messages, and photos that I look back at now are so embarrassing of my, you know, sushi platters that I was so proud of, just trying to get their attention. And finally, Chris Park, who was the culinary director at the time, he responded and was like, hey, let's have a phone call. And then we ended up having a FaceTime also. And then he invited me to come to do an in-person assessment. And actually, it feels like such a New York thing. The company like flew me out, they paid for a hotel, they treated me to my second only omakase dinner. So that was like such a crazy like moment for me. I'm like, oh my God, I've always loved New York. I couldn't believe I was even getting an opportunity to come do all of this. But once I got there, I realized how little I knew. And a lot of the chefs that were working when I came in were like, what are you here for? You know, and I'm all like giddy, excited. I've got my knives. I'm like, I'm going to do sushi. And I'm sure they had a lot of thoughts about me at that time. But anyway, I did a little thing. I cut some fish and I did really bad. I was so nervous and scared, but I think that they figured they'd already invested so much in me at this point that they're just like, you know what, let's let her do it. it was right after the pandemic too, or like right around pandemic time, so I think it seems like a lot of chefs had kind of left the city. Mm. So maybe they were a little desperate.
Right. Well, it sounds like you really won the position in a very New Yorker way, because you targeted, you are very persistent, and you just make it happen. And you just make it. I keep saying you can make it, and then you made it. So, yeah, congratulations.
Thank you.
So what did you learn from your experience at the Kiseki? Because it's Kiseki has been a good, reliable place. And the chef is Edgar Valerio, and it's another non-Japanese chef place. And he's from Drellbacco. And Drellbacco is one of those institutions in New York who really had a lot of graduates from that kind of chef talent school of New York and beyond. So what was your lesson from Kiseki?
Well, you know, I was with Kiseki for 2.5 years. And when I originally started, it was Chef Mark Garcia who was executive chef. And I've been lucky enough to work with several chefs, you know, because then they had multiple locations and then different chefs, heads of the line at the time. And so when I first started, it was Tetsu-san. Mm. And I really learned the majority of what I know about sushi and omakase at Kiseki, because like I said, when I was at Maru, I thought I knew how to do all of the things sushi, until I got to Kiseki that I realized there's so much more, because there was a ton of fish to learn and their Japanese names, and just really just having a presence on the line is such a big part of it that I had never experienced because I hadn't done omakase before. So yeah, I really learned a ton. I would say if I were to point out the big things that I've learned, because like I said, it's such a long period of time that I was there that I feel like I learned a lot there. But something, a little story I kind of like to tell is when I first started, Tetsu-san didn't really speak with me much. It was just sort of like I didn't bother him. I was just hopeful the other chefs would show me something. And finally, when he did start to show me something, he made me this little wad of, it was basically like a little bit of tissue paper with some rubber bands wrapped around it. And he told me to just sort of do this motion over and over. It's just like holding the paper in my hand and wadding it up over and over as if I was balling up rice. He's like, go home, do this on the train. And I think it just sort of shows how intense this cuisine is taken, you know, like how important all the little details are, and just realizing that you can't just jump right into it. It's something that you have to be building on, and it's, you know, a feeling. I've had people say that before. They're like showing me how to break down the fish, and they're like, you know, you go like this, they're like, you'll just feel it. I'm like, feel what? I gotta do it like 100 times before you start to kind of like feel what they're talking about.
Hey, that's interesting. That reminds me of the, you know, film Jiro Dreams of Sushi. To become a sushi master in a traditional way, you just repeat and repeat until it becomes a part of you, that kind of mindset. So Tetsu-san, I think, taught you, right? Interesting. So you said you are dancing before your chef's career. So do you think it's similar to dancing to acquire some skills?
Yeah, I mean, oh gosh, you know, I danced like as a kid, but I it was serious to me even as a kid. And the teachers were intense, and it was like, you know, if you don't get these steps down, we're gonna move you to the back of the line day of performance. So that's kind of how it feels. It's just like, it's kind of scary if someone's critiquing you so harshly, but I also think that it shows that they actually care about what's being done. And so, yeah, I would say it's similar in that way.
Interesting. All right. So we'll take a quick break here. And when we come back, we'll dive into Morgan's impressive job at Hoseki. So please stay with us.
Today's program is brought to you by Corin, a supplier of Japanese chef knives and restaurant supplies. Corin is proud of their Japanese culture and traditions, but they want you to know that their products are not just for Japanese restaurants. The knives and tableware bring out the best qualities of food from every culture and fit into every restaurant, from French to Pan-Asian to American, and that is why they're located in New York City, where people from every country in the world come to eat. Corin's Tribeca showroom is home to the most extensive collection of Japanese chef knives in the world, including Japan. Stop by to view their exquisitely designed tableware and the rarest natural sharpening stones. They have a whole range of knife services, from repair and rust removal to reshaping and realigning. Corin is dedicated to this ideal, bringing the highest quality Japanese design to your table so you can experience the unparalleled quality of Japanese craftsmanship in your home or restaurant. For more information, visit corin.com.
Welcome back. You're listening to Japan Eats on Heritage Radio Network, HRN. I'm your host, Akiko Katayama, and my guest today is Morgan Rasmussen, who is a chef at Hoseki, a six-seat omakase sushi bar located at Saks Fifth Avenue in Manhattan, New York. So let's talk about Hoseki. So first of all, how did you become the chef at Hoseki?
Yeah, I was working at Kisaki, and I was actually serving a group, and they were drinking a lot of sake. So they were having a great time, and we were just getting on so well that one of the guys was like, "Hey, I actually have a neighbor who started an at-home omakase company, and maybe you two should meet." And I was like, "Yeah, you know, sure, I'll take a number and meet him." And that was Max Weiss. So
who is the owner of Hoseki?
Yes, nice. Max Weiss, the owner. And so he and I met for coffee, and I started helping out here and there with events. I was still working at Kisaki, but then just like if he needed an extra chef for a bigger group for private events, I would kind of jump in here and there. But we started to just build a relationship. I would have considered us to be friends. It's like we would kind of check and see how each other was doing at work. And he's from Connecticut, and so he's been coming to New York for a long time and is really, really into the sushi scene. And so he knows every restaurant and all of the things that I don't know. So I've only just been in New York for 3 years. And so if I had a question about a restaurant or whatever, we would kind of keep up in that way. But I was looking to leave Kisaki just to learn something new. I wanted to work with other chefs. And honestly, I had several disappointing interviews. So I started to think that if I wanted to work in any type of Michelin starred spot, that I would have to just change cuisines altogether. Which I did for all of 1 week. And then, I got together with Max, and he told me about the opportunity to work with him at Hoseki. And I never really felt qualified to do something like that, but I was excited that he would have even considered me and trusted that he's, you know, a good friend. And this was just such a special opportunity that I couldn't say no.
Interesting. Sounds like it's very organic and also kind of destiny too. Interesting. Yeah. Right. So what is the concept of Hoseki, and what menu do you offer at Hoseki?
Hoseki is a six-seat lunch omakase spot on the vault floor of Saks. It's an hour seating, 12-course tasting. I kind of play with the menu here and there, but for now it's a soup, oyster, 9 pieces of nigiri, and a hand roll. Trying to incorporate more local products, but it's partial Japanese fish, partial local.
Right. What's impressive, you know, the Saks Fifth Avenue, of course, it's a fancy department store, and it's the vault level, which is a jewelry section. And the Hoseki means gems in Japanese.
Yeah.
So it's almost like, is that a coincidence, or is this designed to be that way?
Oh, no. Max has thought it out for sure. Yeah, that was, intentional.
Right. And, you know, you are the right figure to be very elegant look, and then you make elegant sushi. So I was very impressed because, you know, there's so many sushi restaurants ranging from just casual sit down to $450 per person, you know, sushi omakase sushi bars in New York. But Hoseki is very unique because it's for lunch and a quick 1 hour lunch for $95, which is pretty reasonable. And the ambience is almost like you just step into somewhere, and when you leave the Saks Fifth Avenue, you feel like, well, what was right? So it's really unique concept. And the special experience, especially for lunch and quick, but very intense, real sushi experience.
Yeah, oh, thank you. That means a lot.
Yeah, so what is your philosophy of sushi making at Hoseki?
Philosophy feels like such a heavy word. But when I think about Hoseki and how I feel working here, is like the word that comes to mind instantly is collaboration. I feel like Max wanted to have like an accessible feeling, and I think that's also why he was okay to offer someone that, you know, like you said, isn't a traditional person you would see in this type of role. I think that it kind of adds a different element to that, and has a lot of knowledge on business, and then he kind of lets me just try things, and yeah, we work really well together. So I think of it as just like a space where I can collaborate with Max and with and New York. I mean, that's kind of a weird way to say it, but I feel like I get to see New Yorkers sit in front of me and how they react to things and see what works and if they like it and kind of lean into what I feel like people are interested in. And like you said, since there are so many omakase spots in the city, it's been really nice to listen to them and hear what they find interesting.
Right. Yeah. When I was at lunch, there are other guests there visiting from Chicago, I recall. So I'm sure there are New Yorkers and also other visitors because of location, right?
Oh, yeah, yeah. Yeah, because of the location, yeah, there is a lot of tourists too. But I would say the majority of our guests lately have been people who work in the area because it's like during lunch, 1 hour seating. That's like who really keeps coming back.
Right. Yeah, I totally understand. Because it's such an inviting, relaxing place, but the time is set. So you don't have to worry about going back to the office in a certain time. And so then how do you describe the style of your sushi that you serve at Hoseki?
Style. Well, I think that you have to think about that one.
I mean, like, you know, style could be ranging from creative to traditional. And what's the range within, like, a scale of 1 to 10, creative to traditional? Like, do you have any?
Okay, yeah, yeah. I think that I'm in general trying to keep it really simple. I think partially because it's a 1 hour lunch seating, I feel like it's kind of not as many frills. I do have some finishing salts, which I think is a little bit maybe edgy in comparison to like a traditional omakase. And I still want to keep the menu interesting where it's not just nigiri pieces. Like earlier on, I think it was a little bit more simple, and I'm trying to keep it just complex enough, but more simple. I think right now something that I'm really excited about is the Madai head soup, because that's really kind of inspired by this family meal that we used to have at Kisaki. Tetsu-san used to make this incredible soup, and then when he wasn't there, I kept trying to reimagine what he was doing and try to make it for everyone there, and I kind of was a little like just the self-acclaimed soup maker, and I wanted to be able to share family meal with the guests that come into Hoseki. Because I think that there's something about being like a part of, I don't know. I mean, even just the phrase family meal is just so nice. Like you want to feel like a part of the group. And yeah, so I'm excited about the soup head the head soup. And then I'm actually on soup day when I make that at the beginning of the week, I'm cleaning the meat off from the heads and serving that in the hand roll. So it feels sort of like I'm recycling back in, and it's full circle because I start with soup and end with the hand roll. And it's also full circle because it's like coming from the restaurant that I originally started at and, Kisaki feeling like family and serving that with guests. So
interesting. Well, the soup tend to be overlooked, but it's a big part of Japanese sushi experience. And it's like I remember you served the fish soup that's with onion and carrots. and Mirin, and then it was Rich and Romy, and I was really impressed. That's a good start of everything to continue.
Yeah, thank you. Sometimes going straight for raw fish for me, it sometimes is like, you know, a lot if it's the first meal of the day, especially for lunch. Like New Yorkers, if they're having lunch at noon, that could be their first meal. I think it's nice to start with a little warm up.
That is true. Right. So do you want to tell us some of your sushi examples that you serve, your signature sushi?
I don't know what I think about a signature sushi. I'm also lately excited about, I've been serving skate wing. Oh. I'm kind of trying to learn more about the fish that are in the area so I can get something as fresh as possible, and it's easier building relationships with people, you know, that are in New York. And I had never even heard of a skate wing ray, but they're around here, and it's a stingray, basically. It's a part of the shark family, and that's something that I was excited to serve. It's like I'm slicing it and then torching it and finishing it with Makiku-san from Glam Salt, her ghost pepper salt. So it's like smoky, spicy. I'd say that maybe could be a signature piece.
Interesting. So, for example, I really enjoyed your scallops. That was beautifully cut.
I'm really happy. Yeah, I'm happy with the scallop. That's a good piece, yeah.
Right. It's just the whole presentation is beautiful. And also I think, the care, you pay attention to the detail. That's very, I think it's a unique and you should always be proud of. I really like
Thank
that.
You.
Right. So, but you mentioned a couple of times like salt, but like any other authentic sushi chefs, you pay close attention to other important ingredients like vinegar and sushi rice and soy sauce. So could you talk about them?
Yeah. I'm using two different vinegar blends. I start out with a lighter, sweeter vinegar, and then about halfway through, I switch to an aged vinegar that's more sour and salty to accommodate for the fattier fish. I chose to do this for multiple reasons. A big part of it is that Max really likes, I mean, I think we all really like hot and wet with vinegar rice. So we wanted to season it twice in one seating, which seemed kind of crazy for just an hour service. I'm, you know, used to doing a 2 hour. So 1 hour and dressing in between seemed kind of crazy at first. But also wanting it to be known that we've changed to the second portion by having there be a visual difference. And part of that too, with the aged vinegar, it makes it much more visually apparent. But I also love this vinegar, and I was introduced to it from Chef Mark Garcia from Kisaki. It's complex and my favorite vinegar, so it feels like a little bit of an homage to my original start as well.
Right. Sounds like your choice of all those important ingredients evolving. And you serve sushi on a beautiful glass vessel. Which is like the gem, green gem. So do you want to talk about it?
Yeah. Because it's such a small space and we only have six seats, we wanted to pay attention to as many details as we could. And what we're setting the nigiri piece on seemed like a really important thing, because people will take pictures and stuff, and then you see a lot of the same dishware. And I actually was, I didn't really know what we were going to do originally, but my grandfather was making me some little bud vases. And I was like, hey, do you think you could make some sort of podium style thing for me to set some nigiri pieces on for service? And he and his, the other guys he works with at Fireworks Glass Studios, which is in Michigan, they put together this really beautiful pedestal, and it was like, okay, yeah, we're gonna need those. So yeah, that's kind of how that came about. Yeah,
right. Yeah, that's very effective, and I'm sure your grandfather is very proud of you and having.
Thank you. Yeah, and it's just special that he made it too. You know,
right. Speaking of all those ingredients, you said earlier you tried to be sustainable too. So Where do you get your seafood from?
Right now, we're ordering from several different vendors, and I'm really still. I feel like I'm still new, and I'm still kind of trying to get to know people in the area and who offers local product. But right now, a place that I'm excited about ordering from is Greenpoint Fish and Lobster. They've just been really, really helpful and friendly with me, and they are always sending out an email about what's available right now, or I'll get a text message. Like the other day, I got a message from one of the fishmongers, or the fishmonger, Vinny. He's like, you know, we've got these royal red shrimp from Montauk if you're interested. And I'm like, sure. You know, it's just cool that they kind of, things will come up and whatever they catch. And
I noticed that you had some items from Rhode Island and some other mm-hmm. local items like hirame and sea bass. And I was impressed because it's not easy. Everybody's talking about Toyosu imported items. That's kind of a prized thing people look for. But if you think of sustainable eating with sushi, you really have to discover more. And I recall you said you stayed starched at Rosella by Jeff Miller, who came in onto our show, episode 322, discussed his sustainable mindset and all the practice.
Yes.
So, So what's your idea of sustainability?
Well, first I want to say, such a huge fan of Chef Jeff and what they're doing at Rosella and Bar Miller, and also Sozai. I listened to your podcast about the restaurant in Detroit, Michigan, which obviously stood out to me because it's Michigan.
And Hajime Sato of Sozai.
Yes.
Right?
Yeah. Yeah. So I realize there's a ton of people who have already been doing sustainability, you know, working sustainability for far longer than I've even been doing sushi. So I'm trying to just kind of learn from those people and figure out what's the correct way to do things or what's a good practice and what's not. I don't really feel like I'm able to talk on it too much just because I'm really am still learning. But I think that being as like wasting as little as possible feels like a thing that I can do right now. And something else too is, you know, it's such a small space, just 6 seats, but I'm wanting to serve oysters because I know that that's good for the environment, that oysters are good for the environment. And then eating them, taking the shells and, you know, recycling them into something else.
Mm. Right. Yeah. Basically, though, the Japanese people have a very frugal idea of mottainai. And those parts people tend to be wasting. And Western society and other cultures, Japanese people prize it and, you know, like a hormone restaurant, meaning organ meat restaurants, they're chained and popular. And then we all know that's the best part, the fish, the meat that's stuck in the fish bones, that's called the nakauchi. And if you are connoisseur of a sushi restaurant, it's the best part. So secretly, it's not on the menu, but sushi chefs give it to you because you eat the best part as a regular. So that's called nakauchi. And so your mindset, I think, is very traditional too. And hopefully, the younger generations in any country now are looking for sustainable food consumption. So I think you are doing the right thing. And I really enjoyed your local fish made beautifully into sushi. So yeah, hopefully you're going to continue to work with people like Hajime Sato and Jeff Miller. And it sounds like more sustainable seafood available because of all those discoveries and education among chefs and consumers. So anyways, do you have any thoughts on it?
Oh, well, I, so many thoughts, but I think originally I was working mostly trained to work with Japanese fish. And so I thought that I don't really know how to treat a lot of the local products here. So that's kind of something that I've been just learning a little bit more about. But I think that there are a lot of guests, or I've experienced that there are guests that are excited about local things. It doesn't mean that, you know, there are some really delicious products from Japan that we don't have over here. But I think that we can also just celebrate what we do have here. I mean, it can be just as delicious. And one of my chefs, Chef Garcia, used to say, like, if you're a good chef, you can make anything taste good. And so that's something that I would hope for.
Right. Oh, that's interesting, right? Because as the global fish market called Toyosu, formerly Tsukiji, gradually made by kind of the demand in the whole world's consumers, that basically Japanese sushi started as a local cuisine, and what's available was made into sushi, so it doesn't have to be any specific fish, and it's a very sustainable food by nature.
Yeah.
Right. So, by the way, the traditional Japanese sushi industry has been notoriously unfriendly to female chefs. So, have you faced any challenges being female? And if so, how have you conquered those challenges?
Yeah, I have had some things come up. You know, in Michigan, it really wasn't that weird. Maybe because there's just really not a lot of diversity in my hometown anyway, but it was like the head of our line was a female there. So it really wasn't something I'd considered until I came here and realized how weird it was. And it is frustrating. Sometimes I'm feeling like instantly ignored just because of my gender, or feeling like I'm treated like I don't know anything. I've actually had guests that I've served that afterwards are like, oh, honestly, you know, I was pretty worried how this was going to go. And they're like, and I mean, I take it as a compliment, because I think they're meaning to say it was actually not, you know, it was okay, you know.
Yeah, I think that's a big compliment in the New York City.
Yeah, really. I mean, New Yorkers will say whatever it is they're feeling. But yeah, it's so uncomfortable sometimes, because especially at Hoseki, it is so intimate, and it's well lit, and the music is like pretty mild. So if someone has something to say or a comment to make, like, it's like they'll make it, you know, right to your face. And I think I'm so used to just being polite that I've been too polite, but I'm trying to get a little sassier, you know. I'm trying to have like a little bit more tact, which hopefully that'll kind of come with time. But I think that a way that I, as you said, conquer the challenges, I mean, partially is just kind of letting things go. And I feel like the longer I practice sushi, the more comfortable I feel hearing whatever kind of comments someone might want to make. But something that was really helpful was when I was working at Kisaki, I got to work with Chef Andrea. And so it was another female on the line. And I could kind of hear her conversations. She could hear my conversations. And if there might be guests that say something to her, which might seem, you know, could be kind of innocent, but I couldn't help but like come over and have something to say. Like someone said one time, like, oh, you know, like, are you new, or something like that to her, which I didn't like. And so I went over and I remember saying, like, actually, she helped open this restaurant. So, you know, like, she's been doing sushi for a really long time. But I think a lot of people, it's a weird thing to stand up for yourself and say, like, no, I do know what I'm doing, you know? So.
Right. Well, you are the pioneer. And that's a pioneer's obligation. And
I am so not. There's other women too that I admire that I'm so happy that I get to be kind of, they've paved a little bit of a path. You know, I think of Chef Una Tempest. I admired her quite a bit when she was doing sushi in New York. And then Chef Amberly, we met. I'm also a really big fan of. She does sushi in California. So I think it's really nice to have other sushi females, we can kind of all just lift each other up.
Right. Yeah, I think I would say you were probably the first and second generations of female sushi chef who's been really proving you can do a great job. And it's funny, right? With Italian food and grandmother's food is the best. And why not sushi? Like, what's the gender? And it's really cultural, just a bias, whatever the reason is. And I really think those gender thing is interesting, but who can make the best sushi? And you prove it, and the guests eat it, and nothing goes back after that.
Thank you. So, yeah, as long as they're eating it, that's right. Yeah,
right. So some of our listeners may be interested in pursuing a career as a sous chef. So What's your advice to future sushi chefs in America and other countries or wherever they are?
I think that's a really hard question. I don't know I feel qualified to offer any advice on that, but I think that if I had to say something, I think it's important to just stay really humble and be open to accepting lessons from anyone who's willing to show you something. Because I think especially with sushi, it's a really guarded cuisine. It's like really exclusive and a lot of chefs aren't just handing out information. So I think that you have to show that you really care about it and that you're willing to do what it takes to learn and be really respectful. Yeah. And just willing to take any training from anyone who's willing to spend any amount of time with you.
Right. Amazing. So I'm just curious, what keeps you going? You know, like you are leading the sushi counter and maybe challenging, it must be fun too. So what keeps you going every day?
I like it. I don't know. There's something I just really genuinely like it. It's like, I love coming in the morning and preparing my fish and kind of, it's just like a really quiet, it really feels like you're just painting, you know, it's like something quiet and relaxing and really individual, but then it's also really special because then you get to serve it to people and watch them eat it and interact with people. I really can't believe I get to do this. Like, I think it's, I'm so lucky to have this as a job and it, I can't believe someone pays me to do it. I mean, I don't really know what more to say about it. It's just something that feels relaxing. So unless someone says something not nice, then maybe.
That happens daily in any job, but I think you found your calling. Right. Okay. So what are your plans and dreams?
Oh man, so many. I have so many thoughts. And I, like I said, I'm still so new that everything is exciting to me still. But I think lately I've been thinking more about, well, Max and I are trying to do some dinner services. That's something that we've been thinking about, and we've been doing a couple like private buyouts because right now we're sort of limited to the store hours that we can't do much about, but Max will hire like a security guard to let people in after the store is closed down. So that's been kind of fun to mess around with a little bit, talk more about an extended menu and have a little bit more freedom to do some crazier things, you know, because just in 1 hour it's kind of hard to do something more. Like I want to do some desserts and stuff. But I really want to move the menu in a direction of like a true New York tasting. I think we talked about this before too, but like, I really admire Chef Dan Barber and I love like trying to find a way to incorporate vegetables and, you know, make something feel like a true tasting of New York that maybe has a little bit more than just fish. But like I said, I have lots of thoughts. I'd also really love to do some more collaborations with other women, like an all-female collab somehow.
Right. Well, but the listeners who are familiar with Chef Dan Barber, who is a chef at two-star Michelin, Blue Hill Stone Barns, and it's upstate New York, and he's really the leader of true sustainable farming and diet and healthy future of what we should eat. So that's interesting. And I think the direction of sustainable seafood and also sustainable everything, more comprehensive view to sushi is very important. And especially from now on, I think the most shift should be really seriously considered. All those sustainable seafood watch and all those credit has to be more seriously considered. And also, of course, Toyosu Market is important, but, you know, the scope of what we should eat, what we can sustainably eat, I think it's going to be important. So I think, what you are considering really triggers my curiosity. So please keep me posted.
Yes, yeah. I mean, I just want to be involved in as many aspects of the experience as possible. And something, I don't remember if you had it when you were there, but I've been pickling carrots instead of using ginger for the palate cleanser, partially just because I wanted to control the flavor myself and thought it would be interesting to do something a little bit different. And then I remember reading something about Chef Dan Barber working with some farms to make like the best, most nutritious carrot possible. And so I'm like, that's the carrot we have to have. Like, we have to have that carrot here, you know?
Right. Yeah, he's developing a new, good, nutritious and delicious vegetables with farmers and companies called Row 7 and Row 7 Seeds. And I really think I've tasted their products and it really makes sense, very sustainable, delicious, and you don't need a lot of pesticides and all those chemicals. So yeah, and I definitely enjoyed your pickles. It's not like a ginger, regular ginger, and it's really a great, refreshing experience. So yeah. So where can we find your updates online and on social media?
The restaurant has an Instagram page called Hoseki NYC, HOSEKINYC. And then for mine, it's Mo Massive, just one word, MOMASSIVE.
Great. All right. So good luck. And again, congratulations. And I think you are in a really right direction and you're inspiring other chefs and diners. So please keep me posted and maybe you can come back and discuss what's happening with you sometime soon.
Yes. Thank you so much.
Right. So listeners, if you have any questions or comments about the show or suggestions for short topics or guests, please contact us at japanneeds@theheritageradionetwork.org or kikwatema.com. Japanese weekly program is always available at heritageradionetwork.org as well as on iTunes, Stitcher, and Spotify as a podcast. Our engineer is Liam Warner, and thanks for listening. I will see you next week.
Japan Eats is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. Keep in touch at heritageradionetwork.org/subscribe.
Hey everybody, I'm Nick Latham.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.